Yes.
I did. Now how did I hurt you?
You stabbed me.
Welcome to Crime Labs. I'm Eileen.
And I am Adam. Just before midnight on March 18th, 2018, deputies from Hillsborough County Sheriff's Office responded to a series of 911 calls from Pike Lake Drive in Riverview, Florida. The first to arrive at the scene were deputies Berrios, Bassalone, and Danilo. They saw an unresponsive black female on the ground outside a house. She was face down on the pavement, and it was clear that she had been shot at least once in the arm. Laying next to her body were broken pieces of a shotgun, including a barrel which was bent. As they attempted to assess her condition, they noticed an orange hue emanating from a house next door. The light grew and smoke began to billow out from the house. The deputies ran towards the front door to gain entry. As they did, the garage door began to open and a little boy staggered towards the lawn. Sergeant Frank Tagliarini noticed the young boy who was covered in blood as his clothes were smouldering and he looked like he was holding something in his hands. As the sergeant laid the boy down on the lawn, he could see that he had been disemboweled. There were severe wounds to his abdomen and stomach that caused his internal organs to become exposed. As the little boy was being assessed, a man walked out of the garage. Deputies instructed him to lie down on the ground. He refused to comply and started to walk towards the officers. The man goaded the officers and told them to shoot him. Instead, they fired their taser, subduing the suspect and causing him to fall back onto the ground. Immediately, they surrounded him and rolled him over before placing handcuffs on his wrists and putting him into the back of a deputy police car. His clothes were bloodstained and smelled like gasoline. In the back seat, the man began to ramble on, saying, "Allah Akbar and Kiki is the devil. The kids are the devil's kids." The Hillsborough County Fire Rescue arrived at the scene. Medical personnel had moved away from the area to make way for the fire rescue vehicles and the first firefighters went into the house with a hose. Out on the lawn, officers tried to flag down paramedics. The street was dark despite flashing blue lights, and the sergeant used his flashlight to get the attention of Captain Christopher Saunders and Lieutenant Veronica Vitte from the fire rescue team. The little boy had blood and froth coming from his mouth, signs of severe internal injury, and smoke inhalation. Lieutenant Vitte picked up the boy and ran to an ambulance. His body was limp in her arms as she ran. In the ambulance, she decided to intubate the boy to help him clear his lungs and breathe. He was given sedatives to allow the paramedics to place a breathing tube into his throat. Before he lost consciousness, he said that his dad had killed his mom. The ambulance rushed to a nearby football field where a helicopter was waiting to medevac the boy to Tampa General. Back at the scene, firefighter Donald Foster had entered the burning house. The air was thick with smoke and it was almost impossible to see where they were going. The firefighters had been told that there was another person inside, so they wasted no time in going inside. They used short bursts of water to put out any flames that they could see. Foster crawled along the ground using the wall to guide himself through the house and began to lose his grip. Something on the ground was causing him to slip, but it was too dark to see what it was. There were knives strewn all over the floor and they could see a gasoline can in one of the bedrooms. As the firefighter leaned down to see what was causing him to slip, he saw that the floor was covered in blood. The back bedroom was still on fire. Flames had climbed clothes, walls, and the ceiling. Despite the intense heat inside the bedroom, Foster began to feel around the room with his hands, until he had made contact with what he knew was a person. He couldn't see anything through the smoke, so he picked the patient up and crawled back through the house to the front door. As he got outside, he could see that the patient was beyond saving. He carried the still-burning body of a little girl outside in an attempt to get help. for her worst injuries had not been caused by the fire. The firefighter was overcome with emotion when he realized she was dead.
The woman on the pavement had also been pronounced dead. Apart from the obvious gunshot wound, she had also sustained a number of blows to her head and face. The man arrested at the scene was identified by a wallet in his pocket as Ronnie O'Neill III. He was taken to the station to be interviewed and his clothes were taken as evidence. According to the police reports, his clothing was covered with blood. There was also blood found on his left shoe. He had sustained burns to his left forearm and right hand. There were also lacerations on his smallest right finger and on his left thumb. Injuries were seen on his knuckles and he smelled strongly of an accelerant. Despite his bizarre behaviour at the scene and in the patrol car, he appeared to be calm and lucid at the station. He refused to provide a statement and asked for an attorney. The victims who had been pronounced dead at the scene by Dr. Mary Mainland from the Hillsborough County Medical Examiner's Office were taken for an autopsy. The woman was identified as Kenyatta Barron, a 33-year-old woman who lived at the house that had been set on fire, with her two children and their father, Ronnie O'Neill III. Dr. Mainland found that Kenyatta had sustained a gunshot wound to the back of her right shoulder, and there was also another larger gunshot wound on her right elbow. The medical examiner had removed shotgun pellets from this wound. Kenyatta's arm had been broken in two places by the shot, but Dr. Mainland concluded that these injuries were unlikely to be fatal on their own. She had sustained at least 15 lacerations to her head. Numerous abrasions and contusions were found primarily on the left side of her head and face. Her skull had been fractured in 6 or 7 places, and she also sustained fractures to her jawbone, the facial bones around her mouth, and at the base of her skull. Several of her teeth had been knocked out from the force of the blows inflicted on her. Dr. Mainland concluded that Kenyatta had died from a brain hemorrhage as a result of blunt force trauma. The little girl recovered from the burning bedroom at the house was provisionally identified as 9-year-old Renivia O'Neill. A comparison of medical records would later confirm her identity. Renivia's body had been burned beyond recognition, but she was believed to have died before the fire consumed the home. She had sustained what was believed to have been a gunshot wound to the neck at first, but it was later determined to be a penetrating chop and blade wounds to her head, neck, torso, and foot. A sharp instrument had been used in the attack which had fractured her cervical vertebrae and mandible, essentially decapitating her. The weapon had transected her spinal cord, perforating her larynx. The little girl was found to have hemorrhages in numerous locations on her head. Full-thickness burns covered her entire body. Her cause of death was listed as homicidal violence, including chop, blade, and penetrating wounds. Renivia had extensive medical history, beginning with her birth at just 28 weeks gestation. Being born 12 weeks early brought complex care needs. She had a grade 3 intraventricular hemorrhage, which is where bleeding occurs into the ventricles within the brain. Renivia also had cerebellar hypoplasia, a neurological condition where the cerebellum is smaller than it should be. This can result in developmental delays and mobility issues. Renivia was reported to have cerebral palsy and autism. She was nonverbal and required a wheelchair to get around the majority of the time. The surviving child who had walked from the burning building clutching his stomach had been rushed to Tampa General Hospital and underwent emergency surgery to repair a large midline incision in his abdomen that had caused his intestines to protrude from his body. 8-year-old Ronnie has sustained multiple stab wounds to his abdomen, neck, left arm, and the right side of his face. The stab wounds had led to one of his lungs collapsing and he required tubes in his chest and neck to aid his breathing. Almost 20% of his body had been severely burned, the worst of which were on his right arm and hand. After 4 days, detectives went to the hospital to speak with him. Ronnie told investigators what had happened on the night his mother and sister were killed. Ronnie's statement, combined with the word of neighbours and the evidence found, allowed the investigators to piece together the events of the night. Ronnie had been in his bedroom when he heard his parents arguing loudly. His dad was holding a shotgun that was normally kept under his parents' bed, and he saw his mother run into his sister's bedroom. Kenyatta tried to hide in her daughter's closet, and O'Neill instructed his son to repeat, "Allah Akbar" and "God is my father," as he walked around the living room. While Ronnie was following his father's orders, O'Neill had followed Kenyatta into their daughter's bedroom and aimed the shotgun at the closed closet, firing a blast through the wooden shutters and hitting Kenyatta in the arm. Kenyatta called 911 at 11:43 p.m. She could be heard apologizing to Ronnie and pleading for help as her arm had been shot up. O'Neill had sent his young son to the garage to find a knife, but Ronnie couldn't find one. O'Neill can be heard instructing Ronnie to say Allah Akbar, which the boy dutifully repeats. O'Neill can also be heard saying, "Now get in here and kill this bitch." Ronnie said that his father made him hold the gun and he helped to aim it, but he couldn't remember if the gun went off. 3 spent cartridges were found on the bedroom floor. Ronnie told the detectives, "She ran before he could make another shot. I ran, but I forgot to get my sister." The 911 call picked up the sound of Kenyatta running from the house into the street in search of help. O'Neill followed her with the gun and began to beat her with the butt of the weapon. Loud thudding sounds can be heard between Kenyatta's pleas before she goes silent at 11:47 p.m. At this point, another man's voice can be heard telling someone to stay inside and call 911. It was the next-door neighbour, James Gray. Mr. Gray had heard the screaming and told his fiancée and her child to hide and call for help. At the end of his foyer, he saw the silhouette of a man he recognised as O'Neill. Kenyatta was motionless on the ground. O'Neill was holding her left arm and shouting, "You don't understand, she killed me." O'Neill went back into the house and Mr. Gray went out to Kenyatta while he waited for the first responders to arrive. Inside the house, Ronnie saw his father go to the garage and get an axe. O'Neill then went to his daughter's bedroom, where Renivia had been sitting on the bed, unable to move or speak. He took her by the arm and dragged her into the main bedroom. She was sitting on the ground inside the room when her father repeatedly brought an axe down on her. O'Neill began to pour gasoline around the house. A specially trained dog had alerted to the presence of an accelerant in a number of areas around the closet where Kenyatta had tried to hide, in the area where Renivia was killed, and on her body. O'Neill called 911 at 11:49 p.m. and he told the dispatcher, "Hey, I'd just been attacked by some white demon inside, was inside. Kiki, Kiki, her name is Kiki, she tried to kill me and I just killed her stupid ass." The call ended. In the garage, O'Neill put his son on the ground and held him down with his foot as he put a lit match to a tissue and dropped it. Ronnie managed to get up and run to the kitchen. His father followed him and emptied a knife drawer before using one on him. O'Neill splashed the gasoline throughout the house and on his son's clothes and set the house on fire. Ronnie was still recovering in the hospital and before he fell asleep he told the detectives, "He had a knife and he stabbed me. I'll tell you more when I wake up." 33-year-old Kenyatta Barron was born on November 13, 1984. She grew up in Hillsborough County and attended school there before having her first child, Renivia, on July 29, 2008. She was in a long-term relationship with her children's father, Ronnie O'Neill, for over a decade when she was killed. She was remembered as being a loving mother who had faith in God and wanted the best for her children. She had continued her studies at Hillsborough Community College while raising Renivia and Ronnie. Renivia had complex medical needs, but Kenyatta made sure her daughter had the best chance in life. She decorated her room with Disney Frozen stickers and made sure she was dressed in the prettiest clothes a little girl could want. Renivia attended Core Elementary School. Her younger brother Ronnie later spoke about Renivia's experience in school. He said, "There's this thing called Terrific Kid, and she got that a lot." Kenyatta's boyfriend and the father of her children, Ronnie O'Neill III, appeared to be a great boyfriend and father to most people. In 2012, he was ordered to pay child support for his son Ronnie, after a paternity suit found that he was the boy's biological father. But by 2017, he was still over $1,500 behind in child support payments. He had converted to Islam as an adult, and was part of a community group that advocated against violence. There had been some domestic disturbances reported at the couple's home. In 2015, deputies were called out when O'Neill threw a carjack through a windshield of Kenyatta's car. He claimed that he had paid for it, and if he couldn't drive it, no one would. The deputy found that there was no domestic violence and called it a misdemeanor criminal mischief. Prior to his children's birth, O'Neill had been arrested a number of times for crimes such as possession of marijuana, driving without a license, and obtaining food or lodging with intent to commit fraud. But he didn't have an obvious violent background. In fact, O'Neill had been a victim of gun violence himself in October 2017, when he was injured in a drive-by shooting at Robles Park. He was not associated with the crime and believed to be an innocent bystander who got caught in crossfire. O'Neill had not been living with Kenyatta and his children at that time. He'd had a relationship with another woman and fathered a child with her, but when he was hurt, it was Kenyatta who sat by his bedside. Family and friends had advised Kenyatta not to let him stay at her home because of his infidelity and unpredictable nature, but they had a history together, and she could not leave him without somewhere to recover. O'Neill was an aspiring rapper and hip-hop artist. Next to the area where he had taken the axe that he used to kill his eldest child, he had set up a recording studio. A neighbour, Walter Ballard, told the Tampa Bay Times that O'Neill had always told him he had demons. But Ballard never thought that it was like that. Mr. Ballard said, "I don't know what would make him do anything to his kids." On April 5th, the grand jury returned a 7-count indictment against O'Neill for 2 counts of first-degree murder with a weapon, attempted murder, aggravated child abuse, first-degree arson, and resisting arrest. O'Neill began to file several motions on his own behalf, including one for a change of venue because he believed the media were portraying him to be a menace to society. In early May, he filed an order of protection for his son. He said, "The state is using my own child as a material witness. Therefore, I am protecting my child from any interrogations from law enforcement." O'Neill claimed to have repeated conflicts with his public defender, Julianne Holt. At a hearing on May 3rd, he told the court, "This has been the most inflammatory, prejudicial, pre-trial publicity and the most malconducted, malicious administration I've ever seen." That same month, prosecutors announced that they would be seeking the death penalty in the case, but in October that year, O'Neill was declared incompetent to stand trial. 3 doctors had assessed his mental condition, and 2 found him legally incompetent to understand and assist in his own defence. He was sent to a state hospital to receive treatment and mental evaluations until he was found to have his competency restored. By December 2018, O'Neill's parental rights were terminated as a result of a protection inquiry, and Ronnie was placed into foster care. While he had been at the hospital for almost 2 months, he had been visited by a Hillsborough County Sheriff's homicide detective, Michael Blair. Detective Blair was not directly involved with the investigation, but he had been called to the scene briefly that night. Detective Blair had heard that Ronnie was a football fan, and he arranged for gifts to be donated by the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. Before Detective Blair left the hospital room that evening, Ronnie asked him if he would stay and watch a movie with him. The little boy was still taking a lot of medication to aid his recovery, and he was alone. Detective Blair called his wife and told her about Ronnie, and she immediately agreed to come and watch a movie with him instead of going out for a rare date night. The couple already had 5 children, so they didn't get time to go out often. Danielle Blair told the Washington Post, "He had skin grafting over 30% of his body. He had a breathing tube. He had a feeding tube. He had extensive damage. Nobody had expected him to live through what he did." The caseworker appointed by the state over Ronnie's care phoned the Blairs a few months later and asked if they knew anyone who could foster Ronnie. They had already made up their minds that they wanted to. At the end of the summer of 2018, Ronnie moved in with the family and began to recover not only physically, but emotionally. After 6 months in a state hospital, the Department of Children and Family Services reported that treatment staff are of the opinion that this resident is competent to proceed and no longer meets criteria for continued involuntary commitment. O'Neill was sent back to jail in May 2019, and the following month he was found to have had his competency restored, so the legal proceedings began. O'Neill continued to claim that he had conflicts with his attorneys, and in December 2020 he filed a motion to have the charge for Kenyatta's murder dismissed. O'Neill claimed that he was acting in self-defence to prevent imminent death or great bodily harm to himself and his children when he killed Kenyatta Barron, and asked to use the Stand Your Ground defence. The Florida Stand Your Ground law allows people that are being threatened to defend themselves, removing the duty to retreat before using force. Florida's gun laws had come under international scrutiny in 2012 when George Zimmerman fatally shot 17-year-old Trayvon Martin. Trayvon was an unarmed black teenager who was walking back to his father's home in a gated community in Florida when he was followed by Zimmerman, a member of the neighborhood watch. An altercation occurred and Trayvon was shot just over 70 yards from his father's house. Zimmerman claimed he shot Trayvon in self-defense and he was not convicted of murder. The law was amended in 2017 to grant defendants immunity from prosecution if the defense is raised in pretrial hearings successfully. The burden of proof had been placed on the defendants to show that they had been in fear of their life when they acted, but the change meant that this burden was now on the prosecution, to show the accused was not in fear. O'Neill alleged that Kenyatta had attacked him in the home on March 18, 2018, and he had shot her to protect himself and his children. At a hearing on December 3, 2020, the state had to establish by clear and convincing evidence that O'Neill was not entitled to immunity. They called three witnesses to testify in support of their case. The next-door neighbour, James Gray, testified that he had heard loud screaming and banging on his door before midnight on the night in question. He said when he opened the door, the foyer was covered in blood, and he could see Kenyatta lying on the ground motionless as O'Neill stood over her. Mr. Gray said that Kenyatta was not moving when he first saw her. This was corroborated by the 911 call when he was heard telling his fiancée to call for help. This showed that Kenyatta was dead before O'Neill made a 911 call claiming that she had tried to kill him. Detective Dirks testified that when he arrived on scene, Kenyatta's body was covered by a sheet. She was clothed in a tank top, underwear and socks, and she had an obvious gunshot wound to her arm and significant trauma to her face and upper body. Broken pieces of the shotgun lay around her body, including the stock and the barrel, which he assumed had broken apart when it was used to beat the victim to death. The medical examiner, Dr. Mary Mainland, also testified about her findings from the scene and Kenyatta's autopsy. The court found that the state had met its burden by proving with clear and convincing evidence that O'Neill was not entitled to immunity under the Stand Your Ground law. The trial was due to begin in January 2021, but as with most jury trials throughout the coronavirus pandemic, it was delayed a number of times. In May of that year, O'Neill requested to remove his public defenders as he wanted to represent himself. Judge Michelle Sisko was presiding over the case and advised him to retain his attorneys and warned him that he could face the death penalty. O'Neill replied, "I understand. I love it. Ready to die like B.I.G." O'Neill asked the judge if she knew who Biggie Smalls was, and Judge Sisko replied, "Yes, I know who Biggie Smalls is. He was actually murdered, but..." O'Neill interrupted and said, "Just like I'm going to be, right? I was murdered a couple of times already before, so I'm cool with being murdered again and coming back like B.I.G. The assistant state attorney, Ronald Gale, told the court that they did not believe O'Neill suffered from any severe mental illness that would impede his ability to assist in his own defence. As a result of O'Neill's request to represent himself at trial, Judge Sisko conducted a Feretta hearing. This is to determine if a defendant is competent to represent themselves to a level that would not deprive their right to a fair trial. O'Neill had waived his right to counsel. The purpose of the Feretta hearing is for the judge to rule on whether the defendant has knowingly and intelligently waived their right and were aware of the dangers of self-representation. O'Neill, dressed in his prison-issued red scrubs and shackles, was granted the right to represent himself and told that he would not receive any special treatment. He was warned that he would be removed from the courtroom if he behaved inappropriately. This meant that O'Neill had the right to cross-examine witnesses at the trial and to present his own defence to the jury, a jury he would have a hand in selecting. Jury selection began on June 7, 2021. During jury selection, the state and the defence have the opportunity to ask jurors questions to determine which side they would likely favour. This process is called voir dire. the attorneys choose their questions carefully in order to only exclude jurors who would not be beneficial, or else they risk them being replaced with someone less favourable. There are numerous motivations behind excusing a juror. For example, the prosecution may want to excuse somebody who identifies with law enforcement, or somebody with an authoritarian personality, or somebody who doesn't have a strong tie to the community, while the defence may want to excuse someone who is liberal and opposed to gun ownership. O'Neill had a team of public defenders in the courtroom to give him legal advice if he asked for it, but he sat alone at the defence table in a heavily guarded courtroom. During voir dire, O'Neill introduced himself, saying, "My name is Ronnie O'Neill III, and as you can see, I'm representing myself in this case." He asked potential jurors if they believed that a mother could be capable of killing their child and if they believed that law enforcement officers and the government could commit crimes. He also asked if they understood the use of justifiable force and the right to bear arms. As the state attorney's office had said they would be seeking the death penalty, the jurors were asked for their opinions on capital punishment. O'Neill took the opportunity to express his own views on a death sentence and deviated into a rambling speech about his religious beliefs. He said, "When it comes to the death penalty, I just want you all to know that me personally, I'm for it. If somebody has committed these crimes, they are worthy of death. Because me, personally, I know a lot of you are religious. I was personally raised Baptist, but I'm now a Muslim, which is pretty irrelevant right now, but I just wanted to mention that so you know you can feel comfortable making the right decisions and making the decisions that I personally believe and the way that I was brought up." Judge Sisko reminded him to focus on the jurors and not his own beliefs. Many potential jurors who had strong views against or in support of the death penalty were dismissed. A selection of the prospective jurors expressed that they felt it was unfair for O'Neill to represent himself when the prosecutors clearly had more experience than he did. The judge told the pool of O'Neill's peers that he had elected to represent himself and he had attorneys on standby if he needed them.
The trial opened on June 14, 2021. Assistant State Attorney Scott Harmon opened the prosecution's case by playing the 911 call made on the night of the murder. Her words echoed through the courtroom as she could be heard saying, "I'm so sorry, Ronnie, help me." Attorney Harmon said that O'Neill had shot his girlfriend with a shotgun, and when he ran out of ammo, he chased her to the street and beat her to death with the butt of the gun. The attorney described how O'Neill then went back into the house and killed his daughter Ranivia with an axe. He said, "She, unlike her mother, couldn't flee, and she couldn't make assertions of love for her father. She couldn't beg for that life. Ranivia was unable to say stop, please daddy, please stop. The evidence will show that she was totally helpless." The prosecutor told the jury what had happened to Ronnie and how he survived and told paramedics that his father had killed his mother. As his own legal counsel, O'Neill began his address with his head bowed and his palms together. He appeared composed until he began to loudly shout that the evidence had been tampered with and his son had been coached to testify against him.
"The evidence is going to show that we are under some of the most vicious lying ever seen.
He told the jury that he looked alone, but he was backed by a mighty God. He said, "I am a certain justifiable homicide because I acted in self-defense and moved to protect myself and my children." He claimed that she had threatened to kill him with a knife a few weeks before the incident, and that she was angry about the relationship between him and the mother of his other child. As he ended his 30-minute opening statement, he proclaimed, "This whole entire case has been tampered with and fabricated. My son did not witness me viciously beat his mom to death. The evidence is going to show that your reps in LA wanted to make it seem like I'm some sort of menace to society. I guarantee you I wouldn't waste your time. I would have already taken a plea deal of some kind if I knew I did something like this. Media reports said that someone in the gallery had stood up and shouted at O'Neill, "They're going to burn your fucking ass."
James Gray testified about Kenyatta banging on his front door and walking through the bloodstained foyer and seeing her lying on the pavement outside. He said, "There was blood everywhere." The shotgun was shown to the court by crime scene investigator Matthew Evans, and the prosecutors pointed out parts of the weapon that had bent, allegedly when it was used to kill Kenyatta. O'Neill requested to hold the shotgun, but the prosecution said that they didn't think it was appropriate. O'Neill told the judge, "I'm not some convict, I'm innocent until proven guilty, but y'all treat me like you don't know that." Judge Sisko allowed the attorneys on standby to represent O'Neill hold the weapon instead. Testimony then came from the first responders who attended the scene on the night of Kenyatta and Ranivia's murder. Sergeant Frank Tagliarini spoke about seeing Ronnie for the first time. He said, "A young child appeared to be about 9 years old, looked to be about the same size as my son, came walking, struggling, to where I was in the front yard." Sergeant Tagliarini said that Ronnie's clothes were still smouldering. He told the court, "He appeared to have blood coming from his mouth. He was severely injured in his abdomen area. As I remember it, he had been disemboweled. It was pretty severe." Lieutenant Howard Wooden also testified about seeing Ronnie walk out. He said, "He was covered from head to toe in blood and he was grasping his abdomen and holding his organs." Lieutenant Wooden also spoke about O'Neill's actions when he walked out of the house. He said, "When I reached out to grab his left wrist to put the handcuffs on, he immediately jumped to his feet." He told the jury that after he refused to comply, he was subdued with the use of a taser. Lieutenant Veronica Vitti testified about taking Ronnie from the scene to an ambulance before he was transported by helicopter to Tampa General Hospital. She told the court that the little boy spoke before he lost consciousness.
"I believe he said, 'My dad killed my mom,' or 'My dad shot my mom.'"
Donald Foster, the firefighter who had carried Renivia's body from the burning house, testified about what he saw inside. He told the court, "We also had at that point, I don't remember if it was a deputy or a bystander, came by and said there's another child inside the house. I kind of felt around to see if I could locate a patient there, but there was nothing. There were knives strewn all over the floor. It looked like someone took a knife drawer and poured it out on the floor." He spoke about how he realised the floor was covered in blood and entering the back bedroom, which was engulfed in flames.
"I found that I was slipping, which I couldn't figure out why, because I hadn't applied a lot of water. So I ducked down to the ground to try to see exactly what I was slipping on, and I realised that the floor was covered in blood."
When his hand met Renivia's body, he said that he thought he had found a patient, but he realised she was dead when he brought her outside. The prosecutor asked him what he did at that point. Choking back emotion, Foster replied,
Hugged my other firefighter and cried, to be honest with you."
On the third day of the trial, Ronnie, who was now 11 years old, testified via video link. Sitting in a room in another location next to an emotional support dog called Tibet, he answered the assistant state attorney's questions about general aspects of his life. Ronnie said that he had just finished fifth grade. He told the prosecutor what he liked to do in his spare time and that he had a new family with five siblings and he had a new name. Attorney Ron Gale asked Ronnie what he remembered from the night, and Ronnie said that he remembered hearing his parents arguing and seeing his father with a shotgun. He described being told to repeat the words Allah Akbar before hearing a gunshot, and being told to get back inside and kill this B-word. He said that his father made him hold the gun, but he didn't remember if they fired a shot. He was told to get a hunting knife from the garage and remembered seeing his mother run out of the house while he was standing by the house phone in the hallway. After a short time, his dad came back inside and got an axe from the garage. He described seeing the attack on his sister.
"Did he do something to your sister?"
"Yes, he hit her with an axe in the head, and then in the back, and then the head. And then I saw her eyes roll, and then there was blood everywhere."
"Was she on the floor when he did that?"
"Yes."
"Okay, just inside the bedroom door?"
"Yes."
"Was able to make any noises? Was she making any kind of noise while this was happening?"
"After the hit in the back, she like cried. She cried like she went. Like, she cried."
"Okay."
"A little bit, and then hit her in the head."
"And when he hit her in the head?
Yes.
And did she stop crying when he hit her in the head?
Yes.
He described being pinned down in the garage.
And then he went in the garage, I followed him. And then he put me on the ground. He put me on the ground. And then he like had his foot on top. I was laying on my stomach, he had his foot on top of me. And he was holding me down. And he was like lighting a match. He was lighting a match with the tissue. And then he threw it down.
He said that he was able to run from the garage and go to the kitchen.
Do you ever remember your father cutting you or stabbing you with anything?
So when he tried to put me on the fire or whatever, he tried to light the match and put me on fire. I quickly ran up and went in the kitchen. And then I backed up. He like opened a drawer and then I remember like my mind just like I was understanding anything. And then I walked out the front door.
O'Neill was allowed to cross-examine the little boy he had allegedly tried to kill. He was instructed to use Ronnie's new legal name. As O'Neill stood in front of the monitor where Ronnie could see and hear him, they exchanged words.
How you doing?
Good.
It's good to see you, man.
Good to see you, too.
Do you remember doing an interview with Detective Dirks?
Yes.
Did you guys go to basketball and football games and things like that together?
I'm sorry, say that again.
Did you guys go to a Bucks game together?
Yes.
Did you guys talk about anything that happened that night?
No.
No? At any time did he talk to you about those things and tell you what to say here today?
No.
What about your new dad?
No.
Did you see me beat your mom?
No.
Did you see me shoot your mom?
No.
Are you sure?
Yes.
O'Neill asked Ronnie what he remembered from that night and if he had seen him shoot or beat his mother. Ronnie said that he had heard the gunshot from the living room. O'Neill was expected to be inappropriate and cruel during his questioning of the young witness, but he was careful in alluding to inconsistencies in the boy's statements to the police and O'Neill's legal team. The most heartbreaking exchange came when O'Neill questioned his biological son about what happened to him on that night.
Did I hurt you that night of this incident?
Yes.
I did. And how did I hurt you?
You stabbed me.
On redirect, the prosecution clarified that Ronnie's initial statements were taken while he was medicated in hospital. On the next day of testimony, O'Neill's stepfather, Billy Smith, testified and told the jury that he had received a phone call from O'Neill on the night of the murders. The call had gone through at 11:48 p.m.
He told me, Kiki is trying to kill me, Kiki is trying to kill me, they're trying to kill me.
Okay. And then what did he do?
And there was so much noise behind the background of the phone, and next thing I know, the phone just went dead.
Mr. Smith said he became concerned when O'Neill didn't answer the phone as he tried to call him back. So they rushed to the house and found that it was surrounded by emergency vehicles. A forensic analyst was called to testify about the items he had examined that were confirmed to have traces of an accelerant on them. The only item he tested that did not test positive for gasoline was the control swab. Fire investigators testified next. Jeffrey Batts, a canine handler and fire investigator, was called to the scene to determine the cause of the fire. His dog, Booker, alerted to the scent of gasoline in a number of locations throughout the house and on a number of items, including the children's clothes and bedrooms. it was determined that the fire had three places of origin. Renivia's bedroom, where Kenyatta had hidden in the closet, the master bedroom where Renivia was killed, and in the living room. Hillsborough Fire Rescue investigator James Bacon told the court that there was a lawnmower found on its side inside the house. The lid for the gas tank was missing and the fuel had spilled out onto the floor. There were pieces of white cloth or tissue found inside, like the tissue Ronnie had testified that he saw his father holding when he struck a match. O'Neill's burn injuries were believed to have been flashback burns. The type of injury seen on O'Neill's hand is usually sustained when someone is holding something that is set alight. Pediatric doctor Carol Lilly testified that Ronnie was in critical condition on a ventilator after arriving at the hospital. O'Neill hung his head as he listened to the doctor describe the boy's injuries, which included burns to 25% of his body, stab wounds to the neck, face, thigh, and abdomen. Dr. Lilly said she wasn't sure if Ronnie would survive. She told the court that the life-threatening wounds were some of the most severe they had ever seen. Detective Michael Blair testified about his minimal role on the case and how he had adopted Ronnie in late 2019. The detective denied speaking with Ronnie about the case, an obvious point of contention for the defense, who claimed Ronnie had been prejudiced against the defendant by his father who worked with the investigating detectives. Blair said, "I told him early on that we would never have any of those conversations or any conversations about the case at all." Detective Blair's voice broke as he spoke about Ronnie's recovery and how he became a part of their family. When O'Neill was given the opportunity to cross-examine the officer who had since adopted Ronnie, spectators collectively held their breath, unsure of what he would say. O'Neill stood in front of Detective Blair and said,
"Thank you, sir. All that you've done, you mean that from the bottom of my heart to the top of my head. Thank you for the course you've done."
The state's final witness was Detective Thomas Dirks. He testified he had noticed the clothing the defendant had been wearing at the time of his arrest were stained with blood, and he noticed a strong smell of gasoline. Detective Dirks had been the lead investigator on the case. When he was cross-examined by O'Neill, they shared this exchange.
"Were you able to draw any conclusions on whether I committed any murder in this case?"
"Yes, that's why I arrested you."
O'Neill began presenting his witnesses in the defense. He called his former girlfriend, who he shared a young child with. The woman testified that she had been fighting with Kenyatta throughout the day of the murder on the phone. She had no testimony about the actual incident, but it was likely O'Neill's attempt to illustrate that Kenyatta was angry at him to bolster his claim that she had been the aggressor. He called a young neighbour next. The neighbour testified that he had heard noises that night and looked out his window. He said he had heard a loud pop followed by screams, and he saw O'Neill run after Kenyatta into the street. The neighbour said that he saw O'Neill strike Kenyatta three times with the gun, and that he had shot her. O'Neill's final witness was Deputy Christopher Haverin, who had pulled O'Neill's phone records. O'Neill tried to imply that the records had been tampered with, as there was no log of his 911 call, despite there being a recording of his call. He did not testify in his own defence and seemed confused when the judge asked him if he had any more witnesses to call. When he replied, "not at this time," the judge informed him that it was the end of the trial. It was then time for the closing arguments. As he was called to speak, O'Neill put his hands together and whispered to himself. The judge asked him to speak up and he said that he was speaking with his father. O'Neill started his closing address with claims that the evidence against him was fraudulent. He alleged that law enforcement and the prosecution had tampered with the 911 audio and autopsy photographs to make their case.
"And like I told you earlier, you will know the truth, whether in this trial or the next one. Better believe it. If you think I'm here to play around with y'all, goddamn it, I'm not."
All right, Mr. O'Neill, please stop using swearing language. It's not appropriate in a closing argument.
He said, "So they tampered with the face of Kenyatta Barron and put all these extra lacerations on her face, and whoever did it is definitely going to pay." O'Neill alleged that his son was not a credible witness, and he had been coerced to give the testimony against him. He cited inconsistencies in the statements Ronnie had given when he was 8 years old, and his testimony as an 11-year-old. O'Neill said. He told you that he did not see me shoot his mom or beat his mom. He would have to have been outside to see that. He said that Kenyatta had been the one to kill Renivia, stating, "You don't know what happened to my daughter, but you better believe I know what happened to my daughter, and that is why Kenyatta Barron is dead."
I did kill Kenyatta Barron. But I want you to tell it like it is if you're going to tell it.
O'Neill had spent around 30 minutes on his opening statement presenting the defense's case and just over an hour on his closing statement. During his closing statement, the judge had to warn him to watch his language and direct his address to the jury as he repeatedly faced the state attorneys and accused them of fabricating the case. At the end of his closing statement, he showed his daughter's autopsy photo and said he had to see her like that in real time, alleging that it was Kenyatta that had hurt the children and set fire to the house.
Look at my daughter! And none of you know what it's like to see something like that. That's my baby girl, stabbed in the neck, stabbed in the face, burned to death! Look how the firefighter brought her out of the house. That's the after effect. You don't see while it was going down. In real time, my live daughter burned, bleeding out of her neck. I just have one short statement and that's it. But I told you you would find out why Kenyatta Barron was killed, and you all seen the pictures on my door. And you seen the other day, the pictures that they showed you of my son's stomach cut. You seen all of the burns, extreme burns, third degree burns on my son, covering 25% of his body. And that's why Kenyatta Barron is dead. Because just like any father would have done the same damn thing and moved in the same similar way that I did out of pure instinct and passion. Therefore, if I were to be convicted, it would not be by clear and convincing evidence. I showed you several reasonable reasons not to believe what they're telling you. Check it out for yourself. If they convict me, it would not be by clear and convincing evidence and beyond a reasonable doubt, but by malicious persecution in direct opposition of the 5th, 6th, and 14th Amendments of the United States Constitution, which guarantees that a person shall not be deprived of life, limb, liberty, or property without due process in such a manner as this. Thank you for listening.
In their rebuttal, the state called O'Neill's allegations conspiracy theories that had failed.
First of all, the defendant admitted to you in his closing argument, yeah, I did kill Kenyatta Barron, but I only gave her his last three bullets. So, you know, here's where these conspiracy theories fail, because how much sense does it make? He's already killed her, so what else needs to be done? He called a witness who said he saw him kill her. So what else needs to be done by the state or by the sheriff's office here? She's already dead at his hand with a shotgun. So we need to hit her some more. Here's where these conspiracy theories fail, because they just don't make any sense.
The jury were sent out to deliberate and return with a verdict just under 5 hours later. O'Neill showed no emotion as he was found guilty on all counts. Afterwards, the state attorney Andrew Warren said in a statement, "These murders are among the most cruel and vicious our community have ever seen. Sitting in the courtroom with the victim's family, hearing a mother's screams, seeing the horrific pictures of her daughter, it's hard to fathom how someone can do something so barbaric." The jury were then tasked with deciding the sentence to be imposed. During the penalty phase of the trial, a jury heard testimony from the prosecution and the defense on aggravating and mitigating factors that should be taken into account will they decide the punishment the defendant would face. O'Neill opted not to represent himself at this phase of the trial. Judge Sisko had addressed him and said, "I have to tell you, in another lifetime you would have been an excellent lawyer. As we move into penalty phase, I'm really going to strongly encourage you to consider counsel to step in and now represent you." The jury heard testimony from a psychologist, Dr. Scott Maclis. Dr. Maclis had interviewed O'Neill over a dozen times. He told the court that O'Neill's father had been diagnosed with schizophrenia and persecutory delusions, and this can be genetic. He spoke about O'Neill's delusions of persecution, saying, "He talked about these energy balls and energy waves he would see going across the room. That's a visual hallucination. He had paranoid delusions that people in jail were trying to kill him." Dr. Maclis testified that traumatic incidents could bring out mental illness. Testimony from O'Neill's mother and brother had revealed that he had been sexually abused as a child. There was also testimony about the PTSD he was diagnosed with after being injured in a drive-by shooting 5 months before the murders. The state highlighted the aggravating factors. They said the murders were especially heinous and the victims had suffered an enormous amount prior to death. Speaking about Ronivia, ASA Harmon said, "She is disabled, she is vulnerable because of it. She can't help herself at all, she can't even talk. And this is her dad that's murdering her. The aggravating factors that have been proven to you as it applied to Mrs. Barron and her 9-year-old daughter's murder are an avalanche of significance and power that overrides and blots out any suggested mitigation." Dana Hirst Fulguera addressed the jurors on O'Neill's behalf. She said,
"Probably the most important decision you will ever make. As it should be when there's a human life at stake. The trial you just sat through dealt with the crimes for which Mr. O'Neill has been found guilty of. However, this portion of the proceedings will now focus on Mr. O'Neill, his life, his character, and why his life is worth saving."
After 3 hours, the jury returned and recommended O'Neill be sentenced to life in prison as opposed to capital punishment. They had to reach a unanimous verdict in order to sentence him to death, so all it took was just one juror to save his life. At a sentencing hearing, members of Kenyatta's family spoke to the court. Her 11-year-old niece said that a part of her heart was missing after losing her beautiful aunt and cousin. Kenyatta's mother, Carrie Lloyd, told the judge she wished the sentence could be overruled and he could sentence death instead. Miss Lloyd said, "I wish you would have gotten the death penalty. Every action has a reaction, and the reaction to your actions is going to be sitting in your prison cell for the rest of your life with your thoughts. You done what a coward would do. I'm not pleased with the verdict and I wish you could overturn it and give him what he's rightfully due. I still got justice, whether family know it or not. I got justice because at the end of the day it's true. I go to the grave and I'll visit my 2 children at the grave, but at the end of the day, they're resting at the bosom of God. But him, he's going to be so miserable behind those bars till he's going to wish he was dead." Outside of the court, Miss Lloyd spoke about missing her grandson who had been adopted by another family. Although he had survived, he too had been taken from her. Kenyatta's sister, Desada, said, "I don't feel sorry for you. You were sent to kill, steal, and destroy like the devil himself, and that's what you are. So when you sit in that cell for the rest of your life, remember you don't leave out until you're in a box. He took a disabled little child and her mother in the most inhumane way possible. Slaughtered them. If you can't tell what's worth a life, then I kind of lost a little bit of faith in the justice system, because if anything, that's worth a life. Kenyatta's world revolved around her children. There was not a place in her home you didn't see their photos." Although Neve could not verbally speak, she would express herself through her attire and her bows. She literally had a bow a day. O'Neill stood to speak, having earlier said he wouldn't. And he said, "At first, I want to say I'm not sorry for the things I didn't do, and I'm not sorry for the things I did do. But I will say I'm sorry for your loss. Everybody wants to point fingers and play the blame game without knowing actual facts. Everybody wants to talk justice without giving it." O'Neill was warned to face the judge as he kept addressing the victim's family directly. He insisted that he had taken care of his family and refused to accept responsibility, and said, "There is not one person in this world who loved Kenyatta Barron more than me, and there is not one person in this world who loved my children more than me. Do I look like I'm insane to you? and if I don't look insane, and if I'm able to represent myself in trial, you have to ask yourself, why would a man kill his own children who he loved? An emotional voice from the spectators' gallery cried out, because you're evil. The judge addressed O'Neill and spoke about how the case had been the worst she had seen in her career. She recalled trying not to cry when Donald Foster testified about finding Renivia's body inside the house.
19 years I've been at this job. I've seen human beings killed at the hands of others in every way imaginable. You name it, I've seen shootings, stabbings, drownings, suffocating, blown apart by cars and DUI manslaughter cases. Horrible thing. This is the worst case I have ever seen as far as the facts go. When they fire the person from fire department, when he testified, and when he said that he retrieved the body of Renivia O'Neill from the home, and all he could do was sob. Took every ounce I had not to start sobbing too. Because there is no way any person with any feeling could have witnessed or seen the photos of what occurred that night and not be haunted for the rest of your life. I know I will be. For the rest of my life, I'll be haunted by what I saw as far as the evidence. And just the abject cruelty of it all. The abject cruelty. And I was aware there was some evidence, at least, that when you needed to recover from your gunshot wound, because I knew that Miss Barron was not with you romantically at the time, and I knew that she just out of the goodness of her heart let you come stay with her. And it is beyond tragic that that critical decision ended in so much horror for her and for her children. It is unspeakably cruel what happened as a result of that one decision. The way that Ms. Barron died was horrific, and that 911 call, which captured truly all of it. You heard, and everyone who's heard that 911 call, heard a death scream. If anybody ever wants to know what it sounds like before a human being dies, knowing that their death is imminent, that's exactly what it is. That was a death scream. What happened to little Renivia and to little Ron, but I'm going to focus on Renivia, because she was special. And you can tell Miss Barron had done everything she could to create a beautiful home for her family. I noticed that the Renivia's bedroom, before you set it on fire, you can tell she tried so hard to make her feel like a princess. She did, Kenyatta did everything she could. And I noticed, too, in the kitchen, on the refrigerator, she put up magnets that said faith, love, family, hope. And then you know what else happened at the refrigerator during that night? It got splattered with blood all over it due to what happened. Little Renivia, she couldn't scream, she couldn't run away, and she witnessed what you did to her mother for shooting her mother in the arm with a gunshot. She knew. And the horror that that child suffered. And she already had a life where she was born with challenges regarding her physical and her mental disabilities. But the pain and suffering that she suffered that night at your hands, unspeakable, absolutely unspeakable. And at the moment, that first time you struck her with that hatchet, and little Ronnie testified that all he could see was tears coming out of his sister's face. At that moment, that child knew she was being betrayed in the cruelest, most tragic and sorrowful way that a child could ever be betrayed. She was being betrayed by her parent, the one person that should be there to protect their children and love them and keep them from harm. And that was the last thing that child felt before she passed on from this earth, was your utter, cruel betrayal to her. And I read somewhere, and I don't know if it's true or not, I have no idea,
but I read somewhere that souls pick their lives and that they know exactly how difficult their lives are going to be before they enter into this world. And I don't know if that's true or not, but if it is, Ranivia O'Neal is one of the bravest souls I have ever come across in my 54 years on this planet. One of the bravest ever, ever, because she suffered so traumatically.
Ronnie O'Neal was sentenced on July 23, 2021. He received 3 life sentences plus consecutive sentences, totaling 60 years for his crimes. He will never be released from prison. Ronnie lives with his adoptive family and is said to be recovering better than anyone could have imagined. Danielle Blair told the Washington Post, "I can't believe where he is and what he has managed to work through and process, and really how much healing has happened in such a short period of time. He is just an incredible, loving little boy, and that might happen to him, but really, it doesn't define him."